People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Opioid agonist treatment, or opioid agonist therapy, or OAT for short, is a treatment for addiction to opioids like heroin, fentanyl, and oxycodone. It involves taking an opioid agonist, like methadone or buprenorphine, to prevent withdrawal and reduce cravings for opioids. On today's program, we're going to explore how OAT works, what some of the considerations around it are, and a whole host of other issues related to addiction treatment. We're going to hear from a pair of addiction medicine doctors, and we're going to get started right now.
My name is Dr. Jess Wilder. I'm a family and addictions medicine doctor here in Snunamu, which is colonially known as Nanaimo, BC. I work in a number of areas in our community where people are trying to make changes with regards to their relationships to substances. I am part of our addictions medicine service in the hospital, where we support people who are getting admitted who may have a substance use disorder and need support with withdrawal or treatment and recovery options. I work at our local detox facility. I work with our street outreach team, and I have my own addictions practice here downtown.
And we are here today to talk about opioid agonist treatment, sometimes known as OAT. Could you tell me, what is that?
Yeah, OAT is a number of different medications that are prescribed by a doctor to help to stabilize and manage somebody's opioid use disorder. So we have a number of different options available, but overall the idea of OAT is to get on a long-acting medication that keeps people stabilized and out of withdrawal, that reduces their cravings. It gives some protection from overdose or fatal overdose, and it essentially frees up kind of that physical part of addiction that people struggle with and spend so much time in their day trying to address, so that they can focus on other parts of their life, like trying to rebuild relationships, trying to engage in treatment and recovery and counseling and going to support groups and all of the other things that we know really build long-term safety and recovery for people.
Throughout the show today, we'll also be hearing from Dr. Paxton Bach.
My name is Paxton Bach. I am a general internal medicine and addiction medicine specialist at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, as well as the co-medical director at the BC Center on Substance Use and a clinician scientist there as well. Management of opioid use disorder and specifically prescribing of opioid agonist treatment medications is one of my research interests.
And can you tell me, what is the landscape when it comes to OAT? What is it like right now in BC?
Opioid agonist treatment in Canada really takes the form of three specific medications. That's methadone, buprenorphine, also known by its trade names of Suboxone or Sublocade, and slow-release oral morphine, also known as Cadian. So those are the three approved options in BC and Canada, and the medications that we prescribe most commonly in British Columbia. These are medications we've been using since the 60s, at least methadone we've been using since 1964 to treat opioid use disorder. So they're very well known to us, and they are the gold standard in treatment for opioid use disorder. These are by far the best medications we have at reducing risk of unregulated use, and reducing risk of overdose, death, at engaging people in treatment, and improving quality of life. You name it, there are many, many outcomes that they can help improve. So really, they are one of the core tools that we have for the management of opioid use disorder. In British Columbia, we prescribe these medications very frequently. It's a daily thing for me. There are a little over 2,000 physicians in the province who do prescribe these medications at least sometime. So they're relatively accessible in that sense. We even have a provincial line. There's one phone number that you can call from anywhere in the province where you can speak with a clinician by phone and get started on one of these medications if you have an opioid use disorder and would meet criteria for treatment. We have about 25,000 people or so on treatment in the province at any given time right now, which is a pretty dramatic increase over the past 8 years. We've gone up by almost 10,000 people since the start of the overdose crisis. But Our best estimates as to how many people are out there in the province that might qualify are probably somewhere between 100 to 150,000. So we're still missing a very significant amount of the population who is at risk of consequences of an increasingly toxic opioid supply.
What does someone have to do to access opioid agonist therapy?
So in order to access opioid agonist therapy, you have to go to an addictions clinic, of which there are a number here in our community, and you have to basically meet one of two criteria. You have to have a diagnosable opioid use disorder, and we diagnose that based off of criteria in our DSM, which is a manual for mental health and substance use disorders that we use as physicians. Or you have to show that you've come to significant harm as a result of unintended fentanyl use. So if you are accessing the unregulated drug supply these days with how highly potent and contaminated it is, we're often seeing people who aren't opioid users coming to unintended consequences of opioids that are accidentally or maybe intentionally mixed in with their other drug of choice, which leads to fatal overdoses and other unintended consequences.
So someone who had not been trying to take an opioid might have been mixed in with other drugs that they had been planning on consuming to the point that they had developed a bit of a dependence and now they're seeking a way to not.
Yeah, I would say it's less common for us to see that as a byproduct of this. The most common thing that we see is people who are trying to access unregulated stimulants from the street market. And there's oftentimes opioids that are mixed in with the stimulant supply. And if somebody is not using or accessing opioids on a regular basis, they have zero tolerance to this medication. So even a microscopic dose of fentanyl or any of the other fentanyl analogs that are in our street supply can be fatal to someone who doesn't have that tolerance.
So the idea being then that if someone uses OAT medication, they could build the tolerance such that if they are taking a stimulant and it happens to have fentanyl, that won't cause a lethal overdose. The odds of that will be decreased?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, Joe. And really, the ideal outcome for somebody who is coming to unintended harms when they're trying to use stimulants but getting accidental ingestions of opioids would be to start them on a medication like Suboxone or Sublocade. Because those medications aren't true opioids, they still provide that protection, but they don't provide the other side effects of opioids or the dependence. So it gives people the safety without the other kind of side effects of those other medications.
This is People First Radio. Today's program is about opioid agonist treatment, or OAT. As we've heard already on the show, the treatment can involve different prescriptions, like methadone, buprenorphine, and slow-release oral morphine. Dr. Paxton Bach spoke with me about the differences between them. What are some of the differences between the different OAT medications? Why would someone be prescribed one instead of the other?
It's a great question, and I spend much of my time as a clinician discussing exactly this with patients. They're different medications. They have different characteristics, different idiosyncrasies, different effects. So different people will have preferences based on their own past experiences, their goals, and other things like their, you know, other medications that they may be on or their medical history. In essence, they all function in a similar way. They're what's called a long-acting opioid receptor agonist, which means they sort of bind or stick to the opioid receptors in the brain that would be occupied by other non-prescribed opioids, such as fentanyl or heroin, but they hang around for a very long time. So they last, depending on the medication, anywhere from 1 to several days in the system, which helps to manage or mitigate withdrawal and cravings for opioids by helping to to reduce or prevent that sort of the highs and lows of an opioid use disorder, where people are using short acting opioids, they're getting a surge of activity, and then they come out of their system and that activity in the brain falls away and they go into withdrawal. So it helps provide this steady maintenance dose, which to the brain, who's quite used to opioids, perceives as sort of normal, quote unquote. So they help manage cravings, they help manage withdrawal, they help, like I said, really stabilize somebody's use patterns. They're different in the sense that they feel different to a certain extent. They're prescribed in a different way. They taste different. There are many kind of subtle differences between them that may lead somebody to choose one versus the other. Some of them have some more safety concerns around them, and you need to be really. We often dose them at the pharmacy, so people may have to go to the pharmacy every day to receive them, and others are, far safer, so they're not quite as restrictive in the way that they're accessed. So really, there are many, many differences between them, but functionally, they do a really similar, they perform a really similar activity, and all of them can be very effective, as I mentioned, at really helping to treat an opioid use disorder, helping to prevent overdose deaths, and really helping to save lives.
What can you tell me about the retention rate and the efficacy of the treatment for people on OAT?
That is another really key question. So efficacy, it depends on what outcome you're looking at. But one of the important things that I think is worth noting is that in the current era, in the current public health crisis, in the current toxic drug crisis, overdose deaths have obviously skyrocketed, and that's directly attributable to an increasingly volatile drug supply. It's not that there are more people using drugs than ever before, it's just the consequences are far greater. So one of the key questions is, in this climate, in this context, are these medications still effective? And the answer there is we can say pretty definitively is yes. They're still life-saving medications. They still work very well at preventing overdose deaths in people who take them. However, as you've mentioned, the biggest issue that we're currently facing, or one of them at least, is retention on the medications. They're generally intended on being pretty long-term treatments. It takes, it's very variable as to everyone's trajectory with substances is different and their treatment course is different, but they tend to be fairly long and drawn out. And so people will ideally be on these medications for extended period of times, that may be months or even years. And unfortunately, our current retention in the province is much less than that. Probably, less than 50% are retained beyond 3 months right now. So that is a really key question. We're accessing more people than we ever have before, but how do we improve the retention on treatment for people who really are or might be benefiting from these medications?
Is there anything giving an indication of why have things changed in the drug supply that is maybe causing the retention rate to be lower?
Yeah, I think it's something that historically has always been quite low. So a part of this is not necessarily related to the current context. There are many reasons why people might discontinue these medications or discontinue them sooner than is recommended, and that ranges from everything from the side effect profiles of medications themselves, the way that they're regulated, the stigma that people feel or perceive when they're on the medications, which can be quite real. All of those things are more long-term challenges that we continue to face, but it's become very evident, I think, to physicians, to those of us who are prescribing these on a daily basis, that in the current climate, with the drug supply being as potent and kind of volatile as it is, that it's really wreaked havoc on our ability to safely retain people. They're just people's needs are so much higher than they ever have been for. We're needing doses that are higher than we've ever required before. And there are many other contaminants in the drug supply currently, things like benzodiazepines, you may have heard of medications like xylazine or medetomidine. These are all psychoactive substances that are in the drug supply that are not opioids. And so they don't necessarily respond to opioid agonist treatment like we would like them to. That's a long-winded way of saying that there are certain issues that are longstanding that do contribute to our challenges in retaining people. And it's really on us to try and identify those and address them one by one. But in the current climate where the drug supply is evolving so quickly, it's really caused an unprecedented set of challenges.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today's program is about opioid agonist treatment, or opioid agonist therapy, or OAT for short. I spoke with Nanaimo Addictions Medicine doctor, Dr. Jess Wilder. Are there any kind of financial barriers someone might face if they're trying to access opioid agonist therapy?
No. So this is something that anybody can access. It's something that I bill the government for, just like I would for any of my other family practice or addictions medicine work. This is not something that costs anybody anything out of their own pocket. These medications are covered for anybody who's low income or not otherwise on our MSP service through Plan G. And so there is no cost associated for patients to access medications or to access me as a physician for treating these disorders.
What is the outlook for people on OAT? In terms of both, maybe, obviously it will depend on what a person's kind of treatment goal is and what their individual circumstances are. But from your experience, what can it look like if someone starts this therapy? How long might they take it? What might their kind of treatment outcome be?
Yeah, we see a wide range of outcomes in terms of how long people are on these medications, how long they may be relying on them for that stability that it provides. I like to think of these medications as treating a chronic and relapsing medical illness, which it is. So just like something like diabetes or blood pressure, when we start someone on these medications, there's a very reasonable expectation that it may be a lifelong medication for someone. Of course, if the right lifestyle changes are made and the right supports are put in place and the stability is there, people absolutely can come off of these medications, just like they can come off of their diabetes medications with exercise and diet changes. And if that's somebody's goal, and we start working towards that by building really strong support systems, by building strong recovery plans, making sure that they're connected to treatment and recovery resources in our community, and that they are working to rebuild their life so that they have that support system in place when they do decide to come off this medication.
So OAT is intended to treat opioid use disorder. There are other substances out there, things like benzodiazepines, things like stimulants like methamphetamine. Are there any kind of equivalents or treatments to help on that front?
That's a good question. There are some medications that show minor evidence to support stimulant use disorder. And during COVID, the BC Center for Substance Use did release some risk medication guidelines for stimulant safer prescribing, which is essentially the prescribing of common ADHD medications to support somebody who is otherwise dependent on stimulants and dependent on the ever-changing unregulated drug supply on the streets. The best evidence that we have for treatment of stimulant use disorder is more non-pharmacologic treatments. And by that, I mean things like contingency management, substance use counseling, support groups. For substances like benzodiazepines, we are seeing an increased dependence on this because of the benzodiazepines that are contaminating our drug supply so readily in our community. And it's become a more common thing that we as addictions medicine physicians are trying to support. The concern with people who are physiologically dependent on benzodiazepines is that if you were to suddenly stop this medication, you are at risk of seizures and possibly death. So we have people now who started out as having an opioid use disorder who now also have an unintentional benzodiazepine use disorder, who could possibly die if they suddenly stopped having access to that unregulated street supply that they're regularly getting their benzodiazepine from in their opioids. Learning how to manage benzodiazepine use disorder and benzodiazepine withdrawal has been a big challenge for us in this last few years as we've seen benzos come into the drug supply more. And it is something that we're supporting. Essentially, the only way to support a benzodiazepine use disorder or a benzodiazepine unintentional dependence is to prescribe benzodiazepines and slowly and with careful monitoring wean somebody off of those medications over an extended amount of time.
We've talked about that there are different medications involved in OAT. The idea is basically that it's a long-acting medication. What do you think people need to know about what it looks like for someone who is taking a substance like methadone or Suboxone while they are taking it? Or what are its kind of effects going to be on that person?
I think that probably the biggest effect for someone who stabilizes on an OAT therapy is that they are left with a lot of time and energy that they were otherwise spending trying to stay well and trying to stay out of withdrawal. And with how potent our fentanyl supply is on the street right now, that is truly a grind that takes all of somebody's time and energy day in and day out to stay out of withdrawal, to stay safe from the benzo withdrawal that we talked about previously that can be potentially fatal or land someone in the hospital when they have a seizure. And so stabilization on OAT therapy gives someone back their day. In terms of the biggest negative side effects, I think that would be that it does come with a lot of oversight, a lot of regular monitoring by their addictions medicine physician, and a lot of regular and frequent presentations to the pharmacy, which can be honestly handcuffing. If you can imagine trying to get full-time employment, but you have to go to your pharmacy every single day and have a pharmacist witness you taking a medication, but that pharmacy doesn't open until 9 o'clock in the morning. How are you supposed to work in a construction job where you're expected to be on site at 7 o'clock? There's a lot of barriers that OAT therapy puts in place. And I think it's really important for me as a physician to acknowledge the burden of the medications that I prescribe and how much of an impact it has on someone's quality of life. I do think ultimately when people stabilize, the net gain is a positive one. But it's just really important for me to acknowledge how much I'm expecting of my patients to be able to show up every day for their own health like that.
What do the medications do?
So medications like methadone and sustained release oral morphine work in a bit of a different way than medications like buprenorphine. I'll try not to go into the weeds too much about it, but methadone and sustained release oral morphines are what are called opiate agonists, which mean that they bind to the opioid receptors just like fentanyl would. But because they are so long acting, they bind and they sit on that receptor for 24 hours or 36 hours. They keep you feeling well. They keep those receptors occupied and active, which keeps you out of withdrawal. Medications like buprenorphine are called partial agonists, which means that they still bind to that opioid receptor, but they bind at a bit of a different site there that doesn't totally activate the opioid receptor like fentanyl would or like methadone would. And it binds with a really strong affinity or a really, really tight relationship to that opioid receptor. And it makes it hard for other opioids to bind, which means that essentially you're protecting yourself from overdose. If you have buprenorphine in your system and it is bound to those opioid receptors and you use fentanyl, fentanyl has a much harder time binding to opioid receptors and causing the respiratory depression and sedation that we see with overdose. So the safety profile of these medications is quite incredible in terms of how much it can reduce your overdose risk, but it also has the benefit of keeping you feeling well for an extended period of time, which something like fentanyl can't do.
beyond the limiting of cravings for opioids or the limiting of withdrawal symptoms that someone might experience, what does it mean for them? Like, what might their day look like? What kinds of things would they be able to go out and do?
So I know people who are in university, gaining their master's degree, gaining their PhDs, you know, working full employment, raising children, who are on OAT therapy. When this is something that you've achieved stability and you have kind of reached that dose that is meeting your needs, the goal is that you can do everything that anybody can do. And it just means that there's a medication that you take once a day that prevents you from going into withdrawal or having to invest that time that you were previously investing in your addiction controlling your life.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Today's program is all about opioid agonist treatment, or OAT, which involves using substances like methadone or buprenorphine to treat opioid addiction. I spoke with Dr. Paxton Bach, who is co-medical director at the BC Centre on Substance Use and an addictions medicine specialist at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. You shared that there are likely north of 100,000 people who meet the diagnostic criteria for opioid use disorder in BC. You've also shared that in the drug supply there are a number of other things like benzodiazepines, things like xylazine. There are also stimulants out there. I'm wondering if you can give me a sense of what proportion of people who might be having opioid use disorder would have other kind of overlapping substance use issues?
Mm-hmm. Another great question. And it is very common for people who use substances, especially those who have, you know, problematic relationships with substances, that they may use more than one thing. It's highly individual, and people kind of, it changes through the lifetime. What I can say is that that number of people who are using opioids is being relatively stable over the past decade in British Columbia, as best as we can estimate. There hasn't been a huge increase in the number of people using opioids, but as I mentioned, there has been an increase in consequences. The risk of overdose and accessing opioids is obviously skyrocketed. And you mentioned stimulants, which is, I think, a really underappreciated contributor to the overdose crisis. Over 80% of overdose deaths in our province do involve a stimulant as well as an opioid, whether that's cocaine or whether that's methamphetamine. Over 80% of overdose deaths, some stimulant is detected in the coroner report in the toxicology. So they're certainly very present, increasingly present, much more prevalent than they ever have been. And there's certainly some level of involvement of these stimulants in the overdose crisis. And that is probably a phenomenon that is not fully appreciated yet. When I'm talking about the treatments for opioid use disorder, we have relatively few. But we know that they're very effective. Unfortunately, when we're talking about treatments for stimulant use and stimulant use disorder, we have almost nothing that at least no medications that are particularly effective, and very few other interventions that have shown kind of much long-term benefit. So that is another really desperate area of need in terms of research, both to help provide treatment for the growing number of people out there who are using stimulants, but also as a direct contributor to overdose death in BC and in the rest of North America.
Could you tell me about what some of the treatment options for someone experiencing stimulant use disorder could be? I've read elsewhere about something called contingency management, which, as I understand it, could even look like, for example, just offering someone a payment to not use stimulants and have Perdit suggested that that has been something that has showed more efficacy than other treatments, but is also very difficult to get, say, approval to research.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. So there are no medications. There are medications that we use for the treatment of stimulus disorder that have some benefit sometimes in certain populations, but we have no medications that are even close to as effective as what we have for opioid use disorder. There's no medication that's approved for the treatment of stimulus disorder. They're all used off label, and they all tend to be based off of There's not a lot of consensus in the research. So we're left with what are called behavioral interventions as sort of our gold standard. And contingency management is by far the most effective treatment that we have for people who use stimulants. It is effectively what you described. It's based on the principles of something called operant conditioning. So in other words, providing people with sort of small, measurable, immediate rewards to help reinforce behavior change and help them choose more positive behaviors in place of whatever behavior you're trying to replace. And it's being studied and shown to be effective in all sorts of areas in medicine, from the management of hypertension to any number of different things. But for the treatment of stimulus disorder specifically, it is by far the most effective treatment. So providing people small rewards, often in the forms of cash or gift cards, for measurable behavior change week by week, which might include something like abstinence from stimulants. It is a very effective short-term treatment for stimulus disorder. It is one of the most effective treatments that we have. However, the challenges with it are one, that its effects have not necessarily been shown to be that long-standing over time. So it's really important to try and pair it with other treatments that have more kind of durable effects. And the second issue being that it's really not that accessible in the province of BC or most of North America. There's a few jurisdictions in the United States that have actually really moved towards making it a more available treatment. But generally speaking, it's not that accessible. And given the climate, again, given how much of a role stimulants are playing in the overdose crisis, this is a very cheap and easy intervention that we could scale up to try and help those individuals who are using both opioids and stimulants and are not finding the help that they're looking for when it's trying to manage their stimulant use disorder.
But right now there are roadblocks in the way of you being able to try and offer that to someone?
Yeah, it's quite inaccessible. Part of that, I think, is a bit of a there is historically some stigma around the concept of contingency management, and I think that many of our treatments out there for substance use disorders remain somewhat underfunded, given the scope of the crisis, and the second issue being that our medical system as a whole is not particular. It's not known for really investing in non-pharmacologic, non-medication interventions. So we're very good at getting people access to medications for diabetes. Pretty bad at getting them access to a diabetes nurse. We're very good at getting people access to medications for hypertension or for high blood pressure, but not particularly good at getting them access to lifestyle changes or like gyms or et cetera, or physiotherapy that might help promote that kind of some of those longer term benefits. So that is an issue that I think faces us in our medical system in many different places, and in my work, especially in my work with people who are using stimulants, it's particularly problematic because we just don't have any other good alternatives at this point.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. The program today is about opioid agonist treatment, or OAT, a treatment for opioid addiction that involves the use of a substance like methadone or buprenorphine. We were just hearing from Dr. Paxton Bach, who's co-medical director at the BC Centre on Substance Use. Throughout the show, we've also been hearing from Dr. Jess Wilder, an addictions medicine specialist based in Nanaimo.
Is there any kind of stigma specific to OAT or any of the medications involved that you've been able to observe in your role as a physician?
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous amount of stigma around OAT, both outside of the addictions community, but even within it, and between people who are on one form of OAT to another form of OAT. And it is a really fascinating process for me to see, and also to see how it's changed over the years. I think that recovery and wellness is such an immensely personal thing for each person to define for themselves. And so I always try to support my patients who are struggling with feeling the stigma or feeling the shame of being on a medication, to really think about what does recovery mean to you? Is recovery rebuilding your relationships with family members? Is it regaining your health, your financial stability, your employment, your joy and purpose? Because if that's what it is and a medication is allowing you to do that, then you've achieved recovery. And I hope that we can continue to normalize medications to support people with this medical illness, just like we normalized antiretroviral medications to support people who have HIV. Because that was another world where stigma has and continues to severely limit people in accessing care.
Do you encounter any misconceptions specific to OAT that you'd like to address?
I think that the biggest misconception is that if you're on OAT, then you're not truly in recovery and that you're not truly abstinent. Everybody has, you know, like I said, different personal ideas about that. But again, this is a medication to treat a medical disorder. And I would hope that we can, over time, start to normalize that. The common misconceptions about OAT therapy and the stigma and shame that surrounds those treatments really ultimately prevents people from accessing help. And when we stigmatize things, when we force them into dark corners, it doesn't shame people out of using drugs. It shames people out of accessing support. And in the context of our toxic drug crisis and 9 years of this crisis in our country here, we really need to be opening up the narrative and making it a more public discussion so that everybody feels comfortable coming to access care.
Is there anything else you think it's important for people to know about opioid agonist treatment, aka OAT?
I think that the biggest thing that I would want people in the community listening to this to know about OAT is that it's one of very many paths to wellness. It's one tool of many towards supporting somebody with an opioid use disorder with their goals of improving their health or being more safe. And right now we know that so many of the people who are struggling with opioid use disorder are doing so behind closed doors. One of our highest rates of opioid use disorder is in middle-aged, blue-collar working men. And they are using behind closed doors. They're using in higher degrees of secrecy than many other components of the population. And when they are having fatal overdoses, they're also doing that behind closed doors. And I would really love to see the culture in our healthcare system shift so that people who are feeling the need to struggle in secrecy could really feel comfortable coming forward and accessing care.
You mentioned folks working blue-collar jobs in the trades. That's something we see represented in, say, the statistics released by the BC Coroner Service. Is that something you also see reflected in the work you do as well?
I mean, absolutely. Yeah, I have a number of patients who would kind of fit that criteria. Because of the nature of my work of doing a lot of outreach and with a lot of my medicine being practiced on our sidewalks, I probably disproportionately am supporting our unhoused population and our more vulnerable and marginalized population who have no choice but to struggle publicly because they are unhoused. I would love to increase our access to facilities here in our community so that the only place you could come to access care is not in our downtown core. I would love for people to be able to access addictions medicine care in North Nanaimo and South Nanaimo and in our other communities where they currently don't exist and where a lot of people who are struggling in silence are living and dependent on drugs.
Dr. Jess Wilder, thank you so much for coming down to the studio to talk about this with me.
Thanks, Joe.
Dr. Jess Wilder is an addictions medicine specialist working in Nanaimo.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
Our program today is all about opioid agonist treatment or opioid agonist therapy, or OAT for short. It's a treatment that involves using substances like methadone or buprenorphine to treat addiction to opioids like heroin or fentanyl. I spoke with addictions medicine specialist Dr. Paxton Bach. Turning back to OAT, what kind of rules do people have to follow if they're receiving one of the medications?
So it very much depends on the medication. And that's, again, part of the conversation when we're choosing a medication for somebody. If you're on a medication such as Suboxone or buprenorphine, that is a medication that can be a very effective treatment for people and is also quite safe. It's not, at least in our context in North America, there's very little secondary market for it. There's very little recreational use for it. It is an opioid, but compared to all other opioids that are out there, it's much harder to overdose on, for instance. And so because of that sort of lack of that secondary market and that safety, it's quite safe for individuals and for the public. It can be prescribed relatively, it's quite accessible. You go to your pharmacy, you pick up the medication like anyone else would, like you pick up your blood pressure medication a month at a time or whatever it might be, and you go about your life and you just have to make sure you're taking your medication every day. In fact, buprenorphine is even available in a newer formulation, which has just come to British Columbia in the last 5 or 6 years, which is an injection that goes into the skin of the belly once a month, and it gives you goes under the tissue of the belly, and it gives you a steady level of buprenorphine that lasts for over a month at a time. So it's very easy to be on. In a relative sense, it's easy and safe, and so there's not nearly as much regulation around it. That being said, you know, buprenorphine can be quite effective and is a very safe medication, but when you compare it to other medications like methadone, its ability to retain people in treatment is not as high as methadone. And that's pretty evident if you look at the literature from around the world over the past couple of decades, that its retention is not as good as with methadone. So for somebody who has not found buprenorphine effective for them, or where retention is a real concern and we're going with a medication like methadone, it's prescribed in a very different way because it does have kind of unpredictable effects within an individual. Therefore, it's something that we have to really be careful about the way that we're prescribing it and slow and cautious with it because people can overdose on methadone. And similarly, there is a concern about if it did end up in the secondary market and people were using it in a non-prescribed fashion, whether it could cause harm to other individuals. Because of that, it's prescribed in a much more regulated way. People tend to have to go to the pharmacy every day to pick up their medication and take it right there, at least in the early stages of treatment, until they achieve sort of a level of stability and we know that they're safe and able to stay on a on a safe and dose and manage it responsibly, at which point they can start taking home those doses as long as they can store them safely and ensure that no one else gets access to them by accident. So the burden on a patient then of being on methadone is much higher. And it's important that we're conscious of that for good reason, because we want to ensure individual safety and public safety. It's also really important that we're constantly evaluating what is the right level of regulation, such that we're not being we're not putting individuals or the public at risk, but again, really making sure that any unnecessary barriers for individuals to be on methadone are being removed.
You shared earlier that people receiving OAT face a stigma, and I'm wondering if you can tell me about that.
I think that there's still quite a bit of stigma around these medications. I think that we've come a long way in the past, 10 years or so, in the way that we talk about addiction and substance use as a society. However, I think there's still a really long way to go. There's still a lot of implicit bias, a lot of stigma around people who use substances, and that affects. That is very pervasive. It affects the way people receive care in the healthcare system. It affects the way that people are seen publicly or by their friends and family. So being on these medications, I think there's still, for some people, a very real stigma attached to it, where they're treated differently by friends or family or colleagues for being on these medications. There's also a perceived stigma that people feel they either feel or they're told that they shouldn't be on these medications, that they're not really sober or abstinent as long as they're taking these medications. And that's something that we push back on really strongly. If somebody's taking a medication and they're taking it once a day and they're living their life and they have a high quality of life and they're engaged at work or with their family or friends or whatever it might be, then it's really important that we make a distinction between physical dependence on a medication, which absolutely individuals have. They have a physical dependence on these medications, much like many people who take many medications, versus an actual addiction, which is characterized by the consequences. And if they're not experiencing consequences related to being on these medications, if they're, again, living that high quality of life and fulfilled in many different domains in their life, that it's not... I think it's inaccurate to suggest that they're not truly in remission from their substance use disorder just because they're taking these medications. So I spent a lot of time pushing back on that stigma because I think these medications are extraordinarily effective, are life-saving, and can be really, really a gift for people. Then there are also, some more specialized circumstances. So for people who are working in very specific lines of work, for instance, there are questions around whether, an airplane pilot, for instance, can be on one of these medications, or what's called a safety-sensitive job. So that's a whole other area where there's very, 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 I think, important and understandable questions to be asked around whether people can operate safely on these medications and at what doses. However, again, there is lots of stigma where there's the assumption made that people can't do X, Y, or Z as long as on these medications, and the data doesn't necessarily bear that out.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the issue of stimulants. If OAT is one tool in an addictions medicine specialist's toolbox, what else is there?
So I often frame the conversations with patients, no matter what substance they're using, the majority of my time as an addiction doctor is spent dealing with, I think, opioids and based on where I work in the current climate, but also with alcohol, that it tends to be a disproportionate amount of most of our work. So I tend to divide those conversations up into three separate pieces. The first is acute stabilization itself. So how do we make sure, how do we help stabilize somebody who's actively using substances such that they can, we can kind of take a breath and evaluate what our options are and be thoughtful about what the rest, what the next stages of treatment are going to be. And for somebody who's using, things like opioids or alcohol, There's a profound physical dependence that occurs when people are using the substances, such that the withdrawal from them is not only incredibly uncomfortable, but can actually be life-threatening. So it's really important that up front we focus on using whatever tools we have in whatever settings we might have, which does include inpatient settings or outpatient clinics, to stabilize that in that acute instability and that withdrawal. And that for opioids includes opioid agonist treatment, but there are other tools and other medications that we might use in the short term in that period. And for alcohol, we have our own set of tools for that. Once somebody has stabilized from their substance use, once they've stabilized on OAT, for instance, or gone through with alcohol withdrawal, then we move on to the next question, which is what medications do we have that might help support somebody in their goals? For opioid use disorder, as we've talked about, that really is the use of medications like methadone, like slow-release or morphine, or like buprenorphine. Those are our key tools. And we have different medications in our toolbox for alcohol use disorder or, you know, nicotine use, etc. There are sometimes other medications that we might use in that same to treat kind of what we call concurrent disorders or comorbidities. So if people are dealing with other issues, whether that's chronic pain or mental health issues, there may be other medications out there that we can use to try and address those other contributors to their substance use. And we'll put together a medication plan for somebody. And then perhaps most importantly, we ask kind of what are the other resources that are out there? What are the other tools that we can take advantage of to help support somebody in their goals? And that's when things get really individually tailored, I would say. That includes everything from one-on-one drug and alcohol counseling or grief counseling to, you know, ongoing mental health support to good solid primary care. It might include or it can range up to what's, you know, colloquially called known as rehab or we call it bed-based treatment, which is often 12 weeks or more of intensive treatment in an inpatient setting, really focused on people's triggers and their coping mechanisms and understanding why people use and what skills we can develop to help avoid those triggers or cope with those triggers that will continue to come up in their life.
Are there any misconceptions about opioid agonist treatment that you commonly run into that you'd like to address?
Yeah. So the first misconception, I've said this already, but I will say it again, is that opioid agonist treatment is a treatment for a chronic health condition. Opioid agonist treatment is a highly effective treatment that we often use long-term, not necessarily indefinitely, but long-term. And there's a huge difference between addiction, which is again characterized by a lack of control and consequences related to use, versus a dependence on a medication like opiate agonist treatment. So it is treatment and is not a harm reduction intervention, and nobody should feel any guilt or pressure to come off these medications any sooner than they need to. That would be by far the biggest one to push back on. I'm a general internal medicine specialist by training, so my background involves treating all sorts of different chronic diseases. This is an incredibly important and rewarding area of medicine. It's a really astonishing thing to see somebody just get their life back with something as small as a small dose of Suboxone. So for any clinicians who are out there listening, I hope that if you're not prescribing these medications, that you consider adding it to your toolkit.
Is there anything that you think it's essential we bring to a conversation about OAT in 2025?
I would say that there's yes, there is. So first off, it's just the importance of OAT as a medication, as an effective treatment, as the gold standard in treatment, as the starting place for any treatment plan related to opioid use disorder. It's one of the most effective medications we have in all of medicine in terms of providing life-saving impact. Second important, I think, the important consideration, though, is that OAT is necessary, but often insufficient to treat any single individual. People have a very complex relationship with substances. We all do. For some of us, it veers into the problematic more than others. And it's really important to tailor treatment plans for every individual based on their own relationship with substances, their own past experiences, and their own trajectories. So OAT is the backbone of treatment for anyone who's struggling with an opioid use disorder, but there's still much more to it than just that. And the last thing that I would say is just this is more of a public service announcement than anything, but a significant number of the people out there who are dying of overdoses likely don't meet criteria for an opioid use disorder and wouldn't qualify for OAT to begin with. So there's anywhere from a, depending on whose estimates you're looking, anywhere from a large minority to possibly a majority of patients who are dying of overdose don't actually meet criteria for an opioid use disorder, don't use opioids regularly. They may use them intermittently, or they may have been exposed to them accidentally, thinking that they're accessing a different substance, or, you know, just being passed something. So it's really important that we recognize that when we're talking about a public policy response to the overdose crisis, that this goes well beyond just the treatment of opioid use disorder itself. And it's also really important for anyone who's listening, just remembering that there's no safe substances out there in the current environment. Any drugs that are being circulated are unregulated and unpredictable. And I've seen far too many people die who thought that they were using cocaine or thought that they were using amphetamines and ended up getting exposed to fentanyl, or who are given a pill that they thought would be safe and unfortunately was not, and ended up being exposed to fentanyl and died. So really, really be safe. Be responsible. Make sure if you are using drugs that you're around people and that you have a Narcan kit. And Narcan kits can be accessed at almost any pharmacy in the province for free. Go get one. Even if you don't use substances, carry on with you. It's the number one way you might save a life.
Dr. Paxton Bach is an addictions medicine specialist working at St. Paul's in Vancouver. He's also the co-medical director of the BC Center on Substance Use. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.